is Radio 314 on the Red Ice Radio Network.
Tom Montauk is an author, researcher, and musician. Writing under the pen name Montauk, his writings synergize a broad spectrum of fringe subjects, including metaphysics, Gnosticism, ufology, hyperdimensional physics, and spiritual warriorship. Tom graduated high school as a valedictorian and with a full scholarship enrolled at the University of Iowa to study physics and electrical engineering. His intention was to acquire the mathematical and technical skills necessary to develop anti-gravity, free energy, and other important technologies down the line. 4 years later, having worked with graduate students and professors in the plasma physics labs and seeing what soul-crushing future lay before him in scientific academia, he decided he had learned enough to pursue the rest on his own. In 1998, he created his website as a means of receiving feedback on his series. In 2007, Tom wrote and published his first book, Fringe Knowledge for Beginners. He also released a publication about Discerning Alien Disinformation, a technical guide toward understanding the alien agenda and disinformation campaign. Lastly, Tom is the man behind the band called Neptunian Horizon. Hi, Tom. How are you in Virginia today?
Oh, I'm doing really good. Thank you.
Your site is full of valuable information, and I have to say it's really well organized. Some of these sites I go to, it's havoc trying to navigate through them. I just give up, but yours is really clean and easy to read.
Oh, yeah. You know, well, I've got my left brain side to me, and, you know, I've also been working on my site since 1998. Right. So, you know, I've had quite a bit of time to get it all figured out.
Well, there's so many topics you cover, and there's so much we want to talk about today, but I thought we'd begin on the alien agenda. It's a mixed bag of intentions, ideas, and races. Who are the various alien factions we're dealing with, and how long have they been here?
Well, you know, aliens have been here in some form or another, and ever since, you know, before the dawn of the human race. If you look at some of Lloyd Pye's information, he talks about genetic anomalies in the human genome, which possibly indicate that we've had some genetic engineering going on. So evidently some other superior intelligent race has been here before even we have. Now, you know, over time, we've had different groups and different factions competing with each other on Earth. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the balance of power has shifted between different alien groups over time. But nowadays, they sort of funneled together into primarily four different types. I mean, there are other types, but these four tend to be the main ones. And they are what are known as the Nordics, the Greys, the Reptilians, and the Mantis mm-hmm. beings.
So are they in competition or collaboration with each other?
It depends. For instance, Greys, they tend to be, well, the most generic type of Grey is a small drone-like, you know, like a 3.5 foot tall mm-hmm. being. And those have always been described as acting in a robotic mm-hmm. manner, not being able to think for themselves and always having to look up the chain of command before taking any decisive actions. Well, those types, I do believe that they are cybernetic organisms in the sense that they are genetically engineered to be organic robots. So these are kind of like, well, just like in our factories here, it doesn't matter what factory you go to. If you have robotic automation stuff, it's pretty generic, you know. So the Greys, I think they can be used across the board regardless of the faction just because they're easy mm-hmm. to make using alien technology and they're highly useful. In fact, from some of the military abduction research, it seems that certain human black ops factions also use Greys of one type or another to do menial labor. So the Greys, I don't really see them as an independent species with their own agenda. I think they are just working for other factions. In fact, I mean, they remind me of like chess pieces. the pawns, right? And the pawns, they all look the same. They're all short. They're all bald.
Yeah.
They're all out in front and they're the first in line.
I know some have said too that it's possibly that we even created them in the future, but now they're coming back to haunt us basically.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of these alien factions, they definitely do display time manipulation abilities, being able to slow time. For instance, during an abduction, it's commonly known that you can be there for several hours, but only 1 hour passes back home. You know, and that goes for both alien abductions and military abductions. So, time slowing technology that seems pretty simple, but actual time travel, the Nordics they do seem to have time travel abilities. I do believe that some of them are time travelers from our own future. Well, one of our probable futures, because you know the future isn't 100% set in stone.
So. So I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, like, the Greys, they could be working for, you know, whether it be the Nordics, the Reptilians, or the Mantids, but they're the ones that we're going to always be seeing on front, interacting the most with us, just because they are, they're easy to produce.
And
labor.
Mostly when people are abducted, they tend to see those as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what most people think aliens are. You know, anytime you think, hey, think of an alien, you know, they no longer think of little green men. I mean, that's like 1950s cartoons, right? So, yeah, nowadays it's the Greys with the big black eyes and, you know,
so
round.
What are the alien abductions about? Well, I mean, what are they after?
Well, there's a couple different things. We know about, of course, the typical stuff about the hybrid breeding program, you know, taking human genetics and trying to combine it with gray genetics or reptilian genetics and creating a sort of a hardier, a new type of human. It's like a cross between them. But that's kind of like the cliche thing. There's other things that go on that aren't talked about as much in the mainstream abduction literature. And one of those examples, I guess, would be mind programming. Now, that's where they take someone who is perceived as a threat and they engage in a form of post-hypnotic command implantation. So, you know, it's like they take you, they put you in a trance state, and they use a combination of verbal commands and telepathic commands to impress some kind of a particular thought or a feeling or a behavior or action into your subconscious. And, you know, so when you returned after that, you might not know that you have this ticking time bomb in your subconscious that could go off any time when it's supposed to. Like in some cases, it can start working right away. Like if they want to wear you down and make you engage in self-destructive behaviors like depression or irritation or, you know, cutting off contacts with certain loved ones or certain networks, they can switch you off that way if you're not careful. Now, what you'll notice when this happens is that you'll have this really strong, hasty, kind of like impulsive foreign thought or impulse. That you know, if you really pay attention to it, you recognize that it wasn't there before.
Hey, that's not my thought. That's someone else's.
Yeah, it's like you go to bed one night thinking, oh man, this is a great project I'm working on. You know, I'm great. I'm working with these people, and you know, we're really gonna get some truth out there. Next morning, you wake up and you have absolutely zero enthusiasm for it anymore. It's like some sort of a switch got flipped, and there's no logical reason why it should happen. So you know, anytime you have these discontinuous jumps in your attitude or your thoughts or your beliefs, you have to examine that because it could be a foreign intrusion of sorts.
Well, some people say they've been abducted and told they were chosen to be a mouthpiece for a specific alien race. So is that sketchy?
Oh, yeah. That's a huge thing that goes on. See, it's because, as we know, because aliens have not revealed themselves publicly, they're obviously acting in a covert manner. So they need to work through us in order to influence us rather than, you know, being out in the open. I mean, thousands of years ago, it was kind of like a Stargate scenario where you did have them out in the open and posing as gods and having their respective human tribes working for them and warring each other. But after a certain amount of time, something happened and they had to go covert. And ever since then, they've been working through in a sub rosa manner, you know, working through secret societies, working through contactees, abductees, and so on, trying to steer human civilization in a way that's not obvious to any of our historical records. You know, unless you look at the anomaly. So, you know, like a William Bramley, you know, he's written a whole book on different ways that aliens have influenced us in history. But as far as like mouthpieces go, yeah, nowadays what they do is that they engage in a lot of what I call grooming disinformation vectors. In other words, they pick a kid or even a grown person who has the right qualities that they're looking for, usually tends to be intelligence, being a good opinion leader, well-spoken, and so on. And they pick a person like that, and starting from childhood, they begin shaping this person's belief systems, trying to keep them from analyzing, trying to keep them away from counter-information that might ruin this whole scam that's going on. And pretty much getting this person to root for the aliens when the time comes. You know, there's certain people right now in the exopolitics community, abduction research community, and so on, who seem to be of this type, I guess you could say. And you can tell because the information that they put out, you know, has a lot of holes in it. And if you try to point it out to them, they don't want to acknowledge it. So they're very bullheaded. and pumping out a certain incomplete and incorrect
also line. Saying that all ETs are benevolent, which there's got to be some malevolent ones out there. I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, even if you look way past in ancient history, you can see that the gods, the so-called gods, were fighting each other, and some were more benevolent than others. So to say that every single ET is benevolent doesn't really accord with the
facts. You think there are some good aliens helping humanity behind the scenes, like so many people say?
Yeah, you know, I haven't had too many conscious experiences myself, but especially in dreams and the kind of synchronistic guidance that I've been given, I can kind of piece it together from that I have had non-human forces helping me. So, you know, my sight is kind of an example of that, I guess, because I can't really accredit 100% of my sight to strictly my own research. I think a lot of it was inspiration kind of being dropped into my head, you know, which is kind of like the flip side of the whole mind programming thing. Not that it's mind programming, but you know, aliens are telepathic, and they're not just lights in the sky. They're in some ways they're almost omnipresent if they want to be, just because they're beyond linear time, and they have cloaking abilities. They can also engage in astral projection and remote telepathic influencing. So it doesn't matter who you are or where you are, they are able to read your mind and also nudge your mind if they so wish. And some of them, you know, do it for benevolent reasons, strictly to inspire you, like the ancient Greeks. You know, they had the idea of the muses. You know, not to say the muses are aliens, but some aliens can play the function of a muse in giving you a little help that you wouldn't have had otherwise.
So you wrote about discerning alien disinfo. Who's spreading it and why? And also, I wanted to know where you got your information from.
Okay. Yeah, well, my information comes from a combination of observation. I've had my own share of alien abductions by Greys when I was a kid in Germany. I was born in 1980, and, you know, during 81, 82, 83, and I think all the way up to 84, I had, you know, numerous conscious alien encounters. But it was only conscious during, like, the first minute of it, you know, when they'd come into the room and try to come for me. And after that, my memories fade out. So I've had that. Over the years, I've also networked with a lot of abductees and contactees and researchers. So I've had a lot of anecdotal experience, things that aren't really published in the mainstream books. So you kind of get access to data that isn't, it's too anomalous to go into the mainstream stuff. Because like a lot of the mainstream researchers, they look for a certain pattern. And if something doesn't fit the pattern, you know, like if you have 9 cases that say, well, Greys are here to breed us to create hybrids, but then you've got 1 case that says, oh, no, they're here to mind program us and keep us in check. Well, that last case will typically get ignored just because it doesn't fit the pattern. And but I've networked with enough people that that anomaly does become a consistent pattern. So I've incorporated some of that as well. You know, so between my own personal experiences and that, and it everything kind of came together.
Now, with your abductions, how did it disrupt your life?
Well, early in childhood, I think I had a mix of abductions. Abductions from the gray types, who I think try to instill a lot of self-destructive thinking when I was a kid, thinking that normally you wouldn't have until you're an adult, like depression and, you know, some paranoia as well, anti-spiritual impulses. And, you know, I was too young to recognize them for what they were. But at the same time, I also had some positive experiences, which made me a pretty curious kid. You know, I was looking for the answers, trying to figure things out. And I was really, really curious about science. And luckily, my dad, he was a electrical engineer working for Siemens in Germany. So he knew a lot about science and engineering. And so, you know, we had a lot of conversations. So I remember, like, being 7 and 8 years old discussing Einstein's relativity with him and cosmic stuff, astronomy. You know, I was always taking things apart, trying to figure out how they worked. So if you combine, you know, this inquisitive nature with having strange alien-related anomalous experiences, it made me really want to figure out what these mysteries were all
Definitely.
About. But, you know, when I was 12 years old, I did the stupid thing where I looked out towards a starry sky one night while driving home with my mom, and I was looking at the stars, and I was thinking, if you guys are out there, you know, give me a sign. And I was thinking the stars were going to, you know, fly around and blink at me or something. But what happened instead was I think I must have sent out a psychic ping, and the Greys picked up on it once again, which by that point in my life, you know, they've sort of like faded out. Well, they picked up on it, And that night I had this strange dream about being surrounded by these pale-faced beings with black eyes. And the next day when I woke up, I had this new scar on my forehead that I swear wasn't there the night before.
Yeah, I've had strange dreams too, and then waking up with a rash, you know. It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah, people get scars, get bruises, scoop marks. These weird geometric things. That's definitely one of those post-abduction indicators. So in my case, me opening the door to them, I think that allowed them to have a deeper entry into my life and into my psyche and my psyche back then, which had a negative effect, you know. So starting around age 12 to 15 or so, that was several years where I sort of repeated what I went through back in early childhood with the depression and lots of foreign thoughts, you know, which I identified later on as being the symptoms of post-hypnotic programming, trying to wear me down and destroy me before I could complete high school and all that. So it took me several years to undo that and get back to normal and try to kick them out of my life as much as I could. But, you know, that just goes to show that if you invite them in, bad things can happen if you don't know who exactly you're contacting.
So it's basically our choice. Like, let's say one shows up, and I've heard some people say you have to kind of just basically tell them, no, you can't take me, and then they can't. Is that how it works?
It's more of a fuzzy thing. It's not like yes or no, they can take you or they can't take you. It's more of a matter of how deeply they can affect you in life. Okay. So if you invite them in consciously, if you, like, for example, there's some books out there that tell you how to contact the Greys. It's kind of like a ritualistic thing. And if you do that and you call them in, you're opening the door wide open. So once that happens, you're kind of forfeiting any kind of spiritual protection you might have from any positive beings or any spiritual guardians you might have. So that affords the Greys and whatever particular negative alien faction that they're working for, it affords them greater entry into your mind. Meaning they can do deeper forms of programming. They can implant you in ways that previously they might have been forbidden from doing. And, you know, if this goes on long enough and you don't resist it, you start being converted more and more to the kind of disinformation vector that you want to be. So a lot of times, you know, what we see nowadays in those really vocal disinformation types who are out there in the spotlight, really, really selling the whole alien agenda to the public, they're kind of like the top graduates of this program of being groomed and being given a false story to propagate.
So what about the alien chip implants? What do you think those are about?
It's funny. And one of the disinformation sources, I heard an explanation given by a Gray, which is that implants is just a way for aliens to catch up with their human friends, just to see what they've been doing. And, you know, and they haven't talked in a while, so let's rewind and see what you've been up to. Yeah, believe it or not, that's one of the rationalizations.
Friends don't cause friends pain, you know, and mental trauma.
Right. All right, yeah. Well, I mean, in my experience and from everything that I've researched, aliens, you know, they are implants. They serve different functions. One of them, of course, as we know, is tracking. Although, I mean, technically, you know, because they're psychic, they don't necessarily have to have an implant to track you. As far as your location goes, because they can do that psychically. But they can also use it for emotional modification, thought modification, to reinforce any post-hypnotic commands that they give. For example, if they need you to be really irritable and angry and just really off, let's say in 3 days' time when you're going to have a very important meeting with someone, so that, you know, if you were to act on this irrational anger, then, you know, the meeting would go wrong and that would totally nip a certain probable future in the bud, which is what they want. They can give you a post-hypnotic command to do that, while at the same time, when that event happens, they can use an implant that's actually tied into your neural system to stimulate certain neurotransmitters and hormones in order to amp you up even more. Okay, so it you know, it's like a physical reinforcement to what's otherwise only going to be a mental thing. You know, and they can also combine that with actual live telepathic persuasion in person. All the stuff here that I'm talking about, it comes from personal experience and networking with other contactees and abductees. So some of the stuff isn't really in the mainstream literature, but, you know, I've had to talk about it because I've experienced it firsthand.
Of course. Could any of your experiences have been military abductions or possibly Greys working with the military?
Well, here's a funny thing. You know, I never had military abductions until I was about 16 or 17. There was a summer camp that I went to in high school, And it's one of those leadership programs, you know, training you to be a better person and all that. But it was held at a military base.
Oh, great.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it wasn't just me. It was like me and, I don't know, 500 other kids from different school districts in Iowa. But I think after that camp is when I started getting symptoms of what could have been military programming, you know, which was a focus on survivalism, a focus on having a really, really hostile, anti-alien attitude. And it's not because the military is anti-alien. I think it's because they want to create certain agents in the future who might act as provocateurs.
Yeah.
You know, the same way that here we have school shootings and, you know, by kids who seem to be mind-controlled.
Useful pawns at some point in the game.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think what they do is they, you know, they select, let's say, from a pool of 10,000 candidates, and they do this, like, initial testing or programming period to all of them. And then they put these kids through really subtle tests, and whoever passes the test more and more, and then at the very end, they might only have 100 left who are actually going to do every single thing that they're commanded to do. And, you know, some of those then end up becoming the school shooters, and some could actually end up being saboteurs in the future if there's any sort of societal breakdown situation. You know, they can be used to sabotage infrastructure and, you know, bring about all the reasons necessary for martial law and so on.
Hey, were any of these experiences happening in Germany? I can't remember what age you left Germany and came to the States.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I came to America in 1989 after my mom remarried. So, yeah, so the early alien and gray experiences, I had those in Germany. So I know from fact, from personal experience, that gray abductions are happening in Germany. Now, I don't know if that's due to, I mean, there's certain countries, right, you know, where you have different alien groups being more predominant. Like in South America, you have a lot of these really strange ones that you don't really hear about in North America area. But Europe, definitely, I think, just because you have the U.S. military presence there. And also, you know, the Nazis, they had this really strange occult history, right? With the Thule Society and the Real Society. So, you know, they seem to be in league with certain alien factions, which were then transferred to the U.S. with Operation Paperclip and when the Nazi intelligentsia were transferred over after World War II. You know, so they kind of were transferred over and then they picked up here in America. And they ended up becoming the core of the CIA and such agencies.
So do you think we'll ever have official disclosure from our governments?
Well, here's the thing. You know, any disclosure that we're going to get from our authorities, sure, it's going to be disclosure that aliens exist, but it's only going to be partial disclosure because they're not going to reveal why aliens are actually here. You know, so a lot of these exopolitics and disclosure researchers who are pushing for disclosure, I'm hoping that they're pushing for more than that, because if all they want is the government to acknowledge that aliens exist, then I think that's all we're going to get. And any explanation as far as like why they're here, who they are, and what they really want, I think that cover-up is still going to continue, right? So, you know, so there's two cover-ups. There's one cover-up that they exist or not, and then there's one cover-up about why they're really here. So you can have the first without really ever getting the second. So I think once disclosure does happen, it's going to be up to people like us to get the word out about what the real agenda could be.
Do you think hybrid aliens are already walking among us? Because a lot of times I go out and it sure looks like it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it depends on what area you're in. Maybe some countries have it more than others, just because there's a more of a strategic reason why you would want to embed hybrids in the population. But we know from abductee accounts that even the Greys themselves, you know, despite not it being a good idea to usually believe them all the time, because they're known for being severe and profuse liars. But they have revealed enough that their hybrid breeding program, they said, would be coming to an end soon, you know, and soon meaning, you know, 2010 to 2020, sometime in that period. So then the question is, you know, well, once it's finished, what are they planning to do with the hybrids? And, you know, considering how many they're making, I can't imagine that they'd all be stationed in their ships and underground bases. I think a lot of them are being trained to be as human as possible so that they can live here.
Like David Jacobs talks about.
Yeah, precisely. You know, and like I said, you know, the hybrid breeding program is only part of the reason why abductions are happening. You know, the other being mind programming and so on. But it is a big component, I think. You know, and here's a weird thing. See, we only hear about the gray hybrid breeding program. We only hear about humans who if they're not fully human and, you know, they're have a larger proportion of gray in them, they're the ones that you're not going to see walking around too much just because they look a little bit too weird.
Right.
You know? I mean, nowadays in today's politically correct society where we're taught not to point and stare at weird looking people. So it's actually very easy for some rather strange non-human beings to walk around and we just feel like, oh, wow, I feel sorry for whatever genetic condition.
Well, you should see some of the fashion models they're propelling these days. they look pretty ET to me.
Yeah, they do. And actually, since you bring that up, I think there's, I think that's an example of some cultural conditioning going on. Cause, you know, back in the 50s and 40s, yeah, the idea of the most beautiful woman, you know, it was a lot more voluptuous and more human. You know what I mean? But nowadays it's come a lot more to these stick figures with huge foreheads and small
chins. And kind of gender neutral looking, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rather androgynous looking. So yeah, they do look like alien grays, like hybrids, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the men of this world are being taught to value that as a ideal of beauty, possibly so that in the future when hybrids are being introduced, you know, the hybrids are seen as being natural and
so they'll
desirable.
Mate with them, basically.
Yeah, and here's a problem with the whole interbreeding idea and hybridization in general. You see, the gray, what defines a gray is if you look at the most generic drone gray, you know, they're really robotic. They're also extremely telepathic, but telepathic in the sense that you can remotely jack into them and control them and use them as remote automatons. So that's what grays are also used for. They're used as avatars or remote proxies by other alien groups that prefer to hang back in whatever dimension they're coming from and send only the grays here to do the dirty work. Well, if you take that genetic code of the gray and you mix that into the human genome, then you're going to get a hybrid who is, sure, you know, a part of it's human, but at the same time, this human, this hybrid is also going to be more robotic, less emotional, and more easily telepathically influenced. So if you have a human-alien hybrid like that, and you interbreed them into the human population, so, you know, that gray gene kind of gets spread all around, then essentially what you're doing is you're installing like a psychic back door into the human species, making them a lot more controllable, less emotional, and you know, more robotic than they are now. You know, and some people might think that's a good idea because, you know, they say, well, humans are so warlike and we're so emotional, we could use a little tempering. But at the same time, our emotions are what make us capable of resisting control.
Exactly.
You know, emotions like love and euphoria and courage and all that kind of stuff, that would be missing in a robotic person. I mean, think about a person who's on Prozac, right?
Oh, they're totally cut off from anything spiritual or divine.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you think about autism, Asperger's, and those kinds of symptoms where you're cut off from your social surroundings and your environment, it makes you more capable in certain areas, like technical things, but it also makes you less capable in the other areas that really matter, such as creativity and spiritual discernment.
So why would they desire this kind of future for humanity, whatever faction of aliens we're talking about here?
Yeah, well, if we look at what their civilization is like, you know, be the Greys and also the Reptilian and Mantis and certain negative Nordic factions as well, we can see that their society is structured in a rather totalitarian way. And, you know, totalitarianism is defined where each member of the society is strictly like a cell in a greater body or like a cog in the machine. So if they want to take over a planet and use it for their own purposes, they're going to want to have the members of this planet be cogs in their machine. So they want to cut out of us everything that would be a threat to them, be it our spiritual discernment, be it our spontaneity, our intuition and creativity and so on. And then at the same time, they want to enhance everything that's useful to them. And that would be strictly like intellect, psychic powers. I guess that's mainly it. So if, you know, they're trying to adjust us in a way, they're trying to terraform our minds. That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make our psyche more amenable to their influences and whatever purposes they have in mind for us.
Do you think we're being manipulated by entities and aliens from another dimension, like the Archons, for instance?
Yeah, well, the archons, it's funny because, you know, different people have different definitions of what they are. But the general consensus, of course, is that archons are non-human beings with superior intelligence who are here strictly for the business of controlling us and suppressing us spiritually. Either that or barring us from the greater spiritual reality that is beyond their control.
Or eating our life force.
Yeah, farming us for energy. From that description, the archons to me actually, they sound more like demons. They have more of a demonic vibe to them. And so, you know, that gets into the next question about what's the relation between demonic beings and aliens, okay? Or what's the difference between them? Now, okay, I mean, the main difference is that demons, pure demons, they don't use technology. They don't have ships, you know, they don't have bases. And you know, and they don't have physical bodies that they walk around in. You know, they're strictly what the occultists would call astral phenomena. They're located in the astral plane. But they're very good at manipulating and possessing physical beings. And that not only includes humans, you know, as we know with serial killers and mass murderers and so on, and politicians, but also aliens. So it's conceivable that certain alien factions or certain alien types are actually hosts for demonic beings, or in fact that they could have been genetically engineered to be bodies for these non-physical archonic energies. So one example of that would be reptilians. Now, you know, of course I can't say that all reptilians across the board are negative, because, you know, you never know, there could be good guys as well. But what we know is, at least from the ones that are abducting and the ones that are torturing and doing these terrible things, everything that they do has a very demonic and sadistic vibe to it. Okay, so I think they are an example of a being that straddles the borderline between the demonic realm and the alien realm. And you know, the same, I guess, could be said for certain negative Nordic types. Now, you know, Nordics, they also go by the name of the Pleiadians and blondes and so on. They, of course, they're not all blonde. You know, some of them have dark hair, but
they're not all
they look
sexy
human
too,
enough. That,
guys, relax.
Yeah, but you know, some of them. See, okay, if you look at the ancient myths about the fall of Lucifer and the Lucifer Rebellion, if you were to look at how that could possibly tie into the alien presence and so on, it actually relates a lot to what's going on with the Nordic civilizations, in that there was a time, possibly in the distant past, or, you know, if they're time travelers, could have been in the future, where rather strong polarization happened between them. You know, some of them continued being a sort of like a Star Trek character, having a more benevolent disposition. And while the others, I guess, you know, you could say that they grew proud and kind of had contempt for humanity and contempt for a lot of lower beings. So, you know, a split developed between them, and possibly even a war broke out. I think Michael Dasarian talks about some of the alien wars that happened in ancient times, and about this planet blowing up that was between Mars and Jupiter. Well, you know, a lot of that ties into that as well, the whole fall of Lucifer idea. Anyway, the whole point being that even among the Nordics, there are positive and negative factions. So, and the reason why that's important is because in the future, if you have any of these Nordic beings showing up, you know, we can't automatically assume that just because they look like us and, you know, they might have nice hair and nice, nice attitudes, that they are positive, okay?
So how do you distinguish between the truly positive ones and then the fake positive ones?
Yeah, you know, that's I think that gets to the core of the question. And that's one of the questions that a lot of these alien disinformation vectors that they don't want to discuss, you know, and because, you know, once a person learns that, then the whole gig is up, right? Because, you know, from the V miniseries, right, there's the idea of reptilians disguised as humans, and they come here pretending to be peaceful and benevolent and trying to give us technology and help and so on. But little do we know that they are actually reptilians underneath, and that they're here to steal not only our resources and our water, but also harvesting human bodies. That was the idea of the V miniseries. You know, both the old one from the early 80s and the newer one. But yeah, how to distinguish between them? Well, the good guys, ultimately, you have to look at their actions. What are the results of their words? What are the results of their actions? I mean, take, for instance, an abductee or a contactee of theirs compared to someone who's a abductee of the negative types, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you are a contactee of the so-called good guys, you're going to be, well, you're not going to have your free will or your wisdom or your discernment or your freedom compromised. In fact, you're going to have those enabled because you're going to be trained by them on how to see through deception, on how not to give away your power, on how to have a certain level of spiritual chivalry or ethics that is a cut above, you know, what the average human level, what you're expected of in society. You know, I mean, we were taught to have conscience and manners and so on, but what these aliens teach you, it kind of goes beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Versus someone who is actually an abductee or a contactee of the negative types, and they're going to have, I mean, you'll be able to see it in their eyes and their speech, that they're sort of in a trance state. You know, there's certain things, there's like gaps, there's holes in their awareness, things that are fenced off, that are quarantined. And these people, it kind of reminds you of certain religious fundamentalists, you know, how they reason in circles and,
mm-hmm.
and you know, they seem heavily programmed. Well, you know, it's the same thing with the negative abductees and contactees. So, you know, with myself, I've had some of the influences of both, but because I was aware of the negative stuff, you know, I think I've done as good of a job as I think I could have in recognizing it and disabling a lot of it.
I think too, you really have to use the spirit of truth. You use your own intuition, and you can tell who's right and who's really off, you know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're going to be discerning, you're going to have both a combination of intuition and logic. And you have to have enough humility to know when your ego is getting in the way of the truth. You know, if it's trying to block you from researching certain materials, you know, because it doesn't fit your ego identity or your expectations, you have to be open-minded and you have to analyze it. And you have to be really good at looking at what's wrong with something, like what are the discontinuities, what are the holes in the, you know, just the issues with it. So that kind of level of discernment is something that's usually put into you and nurtured by the positive groups, you know, whereas for the negative guys, well, they try to get you as programmed and cut off from the truth as possible.
Do you think sinister aliens have infiltrated our governments in some way to make a big mess of things for us right now?
Well, yeah. In the case of the U.S. government or the military and the Black Ops programs, as I explained on my site, a lot of it happened during and after World War II. Part of it started in Europe, you know, with the Nazis and their occult and alien activities prior to World War II, getting in league with certain alien groups. Like, you know, with the Vril Society, they had those ladies who channeled the Aldebarans, channeling, you know, not only stuff about the culture of these aliens, but also technical diagrams on how to build spaceships and time travel machines and so on. Well, a lot of the scientists, the Nazi intelligentsia from World War II, from the Nazis in Europe, they're brought over to America, like I said, and they ended up becoming the core of NASA, CIA, and pretty much the whole military-industrial complex. So that by the time 1961 came around, we had President Eisenhower, you know, trying to warn the public about the military-industrial complex, saying how it would be a threat to our future and our freedom. Well, you know, a lot of that, it continued on for quite some time until about the 1970s, when it seems that the military groups, whatever deals that they had made with the aliens, they realized that, you know, they were had. In other words, that whatever deals that they had made, it was like a Faustian bargain. They had sold their souls, and now there really was no going back to kicking the aliens out. So I think ever since that point, they have been working with the aliens, colluding with them, solely because they figured, you know, if you can't beat them, then join them. You know, maybe by working with them, we can save ourselves. Maybe we can spare some human lives, you know, by not trying to resist and getting our planet incinerated. So, you know, fast forward now to 2010, 2012, and we've had the Black Ops military, you know, we've had shadow corporate groups colluding with negative alien factions, trying to bring about, you know, as what we now know as New World Order and everything that comes after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, I don't think it's solely a matter of aliens infiltrating our government. I think it's them having made really strategic deals with them in the past, which allowed them to worm their way in and pretty much calling the shots now.
I always wonder where they made that first contact. Like, who did they know who to contact, you know?
Yeah.
Like, which human do we talk to here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as like the government and the military stuff goes, from what I heard, the government was aware of aliens going back even to the late 1800s. Because there was a lot of airship sightings, like mystery airship sightings in the 1880s.
In wartime, UFOs.
Yeah. Yeah, so even back then, the people in power knew that something was going on. But it took another 50 years for our technology to catch up, you know, with nuclear weapons and radar and all that, for the interaction between humans and these alien factions to grow to a new level where actual treaties were made and, you know, deals signed and basically the future of humanity sold away.
Some have speculated that chemtrails are possibly means to terraforming Earth for the arrival of aliens. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, you know, terraforming, like I said, it has different interpretations, right? You know, you get the main idea, which is changing the atmosphere, changing the landscape, and so on to make it more hospitable to them. But there's also, like I said, genetic terraforming, mental terraforming, spiritual terraforming, where they mm-hmm. try to condition the human collective consciousness to be more receptive to them when they actually show up. I did some research into chemtrails back in 2000, 2001, and 2002. And from what I can tell, they're like a it's a multi-purpose program, okay? We know that they contain aluminum particles, barium particles, which are radar reflective. Mm-hmm. We know that they also contain signs of human genetic engineering materials, like, you know, dried red human blood cells. And they also contain hollow nanofibers that disintegrate in the air after some time. So if you combine all this together, like for instance, the whole genetic stuff, the hollow nanofibers, what they're probably used for is to contain viral vectors. Like I did some research into gene therapy back in college, and what gene therapy uses, it uses viruses that have had their core DNA removed and some other DNA snippet inserted. Mm. So that if you infect someone with this virus, it implants that DNA into their DNA. Mm. Okay. And that's called gene therapy. And it uses viral or bacterial vectors, you know, which are these vehicles that carry these DNA snippets. So what happens if you were to take these gene therapy vectors and you put them inside these hollow nanofibers so that they don't get killed by the UV radiation in the atmosphere, and you spray that across the skies? Well, it falls down and people breathe it in, and, you know, their immune system gets compromised by, you know, the barium and aluminum particles, and also the ethylene dibromide, which is one of those chemicals that they have in chemtrails, which depresses the immune system. So, you know, you get infected and your immune system goes down. And it's very possible that some of those intentional DNA snippets then get incorporated into your genetics, okay? So, you know, it's like it's a gene therapy on a mass scale. Only thing is we don't know exactly what the direction of this genetic engineering would be for. But if I had to take a guess, I would say it would be an attempt to offset any of the natural genetic mutations that could be happening now that, you know, correlate with the whole idea of spiritual enlightenment and people acquiring new abilities and, you know, new genetic qualities that they didn't have before.
So what's the solution? How do we rise above that if we're being bombarded by frequencies and chemtrails and who knows what else?
Yeah, well, here's the thing, you know, the cells of our body, our DNA, there's this thing called epigenetics. It's a study of it's a study of how genes turn on and off according to our beliefs and our perceptions, our emotions, and so on. In other words, our mind has the ability to affect what genes turn on and off within us. And Dr. Bruce Lipton, he's done some great research on that because he's a geneticist, right?
Right.
And yeah, his book is really awesome, The Biology of Belief,
I
think it's called.
Yeah, I like that one. It's good.
Yeah. Yeah, so his book shows that it's possible to alter our own genes using strictly the power of our mind and our emotions, okay? So if that is strong enough, then we can actually counter any external artificial attempts at manipulating our genetics. That's what it comes down to. Yeah. And that even goes as far as the whole gray hybridization thing. You know, aliens, you know, one of the disinformation lines is that we have to have gray hybridization in order to evolve humans, because without their help, you know, we're not going to go anywhere. Well, that's not true.
Yeah, like we're not capable of doing it ourselves. Come on.
Yeah, seriously.
Go on. Sorry.
I was going to say, like, no, I mean, look at the species that have evolved, you know, over the past millions of years. You know, most of them did it, you know, on their own.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right? So we can do likewise. Once our awareness, once our perception, and once our beliefs change, you know, once we change at a spiritual core, it naturally follows that our genes would also correspondingly evolve.
Yeah, exactly. And we're not just physical beings. So there's all these other components involved there.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, my main point there is that our bodies and our brains and our minds, the environment, you know, the environment is not the only thing that's controlling them, okay? You know, we have our own spirit and our own thoughts and our own choices that also have control over it. So if ours is stronger than the environment, then we're okay, okay? It's only when we become weakened through depression, through, you know, bad diet and lack of sleep and all that, that our field grows weak enough that then the environment can take over. So, in fact, that's how cancer a lot of times arises. When there's a deficiency in our own field, and therefore our DNA, you know, our DNA is it's kind of like a little robot, you know, it's got like a little antenna sticking up, and there's different radio frequencies coming in. So if our broadcast is too weak, then obviously the other frequencies are going to take over instead, and then, you know, the robots go haywire.
Yeah, so like you have to work at tuning up, basically, and trying to stay in a higher frequency, and you have to do it every day.
Yeah, exactly. You have to keep your vibe up, as I say, keep your attitude up. And if you are a target of alien activities, then yeah, you also have to weed the garden, so to speak, and identify negative programs, you know, discontinuous thoughts, things that don't belong in your mind, and pluck them out, identify them, and, you know, possibly use auto-suggestion and counter-programming to neutralize them.
I think this kind of ties into etheric energy, which you also write about. So what is that and what does it do?
Oh, yeah. See, etheric energy, when I talked about our cells obeying our field or obeying our transmission that we put out, well, it actually happens through what's known as the etheric body. And what etheric energy is, it's a couple things, okay? You got this universal etheric energy that pervades all space and all time. And it's kind of like the source code beneath reality. It's kind of like in the Matrix movie where you've got that green code trickling down like rain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this Matrix code, there's a lot going on in it that once it gets turned into a visual representation, you don't actually see. It's also like with websites. You know, websites, you see the graphics and you see the words, but there's a lot of code underneath it that you don't see. So, you know, if you go to your browser and you go to view source, you can see a lot of this code going on. And, you know, there's comment brackets, there's invisible stuff in there, there's scripts and so on. Well, you know, we're surrounded by this etheric field and we're actually embedded in it. And there's a lot of energies and constructs and things in there that we don't see unless we have psychic vision, you know, unless we're clairvoyant.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one aspect of etheric energy. It's kind of like the ether, you know, it's the substrate of reality as we know it. Okay. But there's parts of it that, you know, when they clump together and they organize and they become associated with a physical body, that then is known as the etheric body. And what it is, it's an interface field between the spirit or between the consciousness and the physical body, you know. So it kind of allows the physical reality to influence the metaphysical and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a thing that links consciousness to matter that allows one then to influence the other. And for that reason, every living thing that has a physical body also has an etheric body, be it plants, be it animals, humans, or aliens. And, you know, the etheric body, if you want to get technical, what it actually is, it's a quantum biasing field. In other words, what it does is it nudges quantum events, you know, at the microscopic scale. And, you know, because like in quantum physics, right, you have these things like electron jumps, you have electrons going here and there, mm-hmm. occupying different states of energy. And a lot of this happens in an unpredictable way. It's like, you know, totally chaotic as far as physics is concerned, you know, and they can only predict the probabilities of what it's going to do next, you know, but they can't tell exactly what it will do next. Well, the etheric body has the ability to shift the probability of these quantum events and therefore direct what actually happens. So for instance, I mean, take the brain, right, you know, with the neurons and, I mean, the brain is basically a quantum computer and there's things going on that's at the cellular and neuronal level that are 100% dependent on these little quantum jumps. So, you know, if like an electron jumps one way, then a neuron will fire one way. And if it jumps another way, then the neuron won't fire. So the etheric body is able to influence these electrons and therefore influence whether a neuron fires or not. And as a consequence, then, therefore, you have your consciousness, which exists outside of space-time, working through the etheric body, then influencing these quantum events, which then scale up into brain neuronal activity, you know, and therefore you can move your limbs and talk and think with your brain and so on. So, you know, that's what the etheric body is. It's the interface between consciousness and matter. And the stronger it is, the more matter responds to consciousness, okay? So like right now, humans only have enough etheric energy to sustain life, to perceive through our five senses, to move our limbs, to think and talk. But we don't really have anything beyond that. And for that reason, therefore, we run into the limitations of the physical, like we have the limitations of the five senses. You know, we can only see through our physical organs.
Yeah.
We suffer illness, you know, injury, pain, aging, you know, also the inertia and the gravity that comes with having a physical body.
So how do we get the etheric energy levels to go up?
Yeah, well, here's a question. You know, what happens if our etheric energy levels go up? Well, in that case, all these physical limitations that we're used to, they start being dissolved by this etheric energy. For instance, five senses, not a problem. You can see beyond them. Because, like, you know, a lot of these Eastern practices, you know, be it Taoist yoga or Toltec shamanism, or even in the West with alchemy, all these practices, they aim to condition and amplify the amount of available etheric energy so that new abilities become available, okay? Consider alchemy, for instance. That's one of the things I've been studying for the past couple of years. The goal of alchemy is to gather etheric energy from your environment and impress it into a solid substance, which then after, you know, it fully incorporates, it becomes the philosopher's stone. Well, it's said that if you take a part of this philosopher's stone and dissolve it in water or wine and drink it, several things happen to you. You know, one, you stop aging or even become younger. Two, you acquire clairvoyant abilities. And, you know, three, you achieve a certain level of what they call enlightenment. But as we all know, you really can't, you can't just take a pill and become a spiritual master, of course. But what it does is it expands your awareness a little bit so that, you know, you can take in more information and remember things that previously you couldn't, in like past lives and so on. So it might seem like enlightenment to people who don't know better, but all it is just flipping on of certain switches that were previously turned off. Well, so, you know, with alchemy, that's an example of what happens if your etheric energy levels within you get properly conditioned and get taken to a higher level. You know, a lot of these limitations that you had before that are strictly dependent on physical things, they start falling away. You know, and the same goes with like certain yoga practices and, like I said, Toltec shamanism. Like, you know, with Carlos Castaneda, if you read his books, he talks about the shamans and how the really practiced ones, they almost seem like they've defied space and time itself. So, you know, that's one of the things that you can do. And in fact, you know, if you look at all these abilities, those are the abilities that aliens have. Nordics, for example, they live for a really long time, you know, several centuries, you know, if not longer. And they don't seem to age. And, you know, they're very psychic and they're beyond space-time. So
although they're matter, it's almost like they're a spiritual being to us because they have that mind over matter principle down pretty well.
Yeah, exactly. So here's the thing. What if your etheric body becomes so strong that it has complete control over the physical body? Well, then what happens is the physical body kind of gets absorbed into the etheric. It's kind of like I know the visual I get is kind of like a landing gear on a plane being retracted inwards. So, you know, your physical kind of gets enveloped by it, and then whatever your mind wants for it, you know, whatever it thinks, the physical body will respond. It's kind of like putty. In fact, you know, it's even possible that you don't even need a physical body then because you can just project it anytime you want, you know, create a physical body whenever you need to. You know, so there's certain spiritual avatars in history that have become infamous for some of the things that they can pull off. You know, like one of them being the Comte Saint Germain. He's a mysterious figure. He's said to have lived for several hundred years and that he was an alchemist and seen in strange places and, you know, never seeming to age. Well, that's one example of a guy in history. And also, I think Fulcanelli, there's some, he's one of the famous alchemists. He's also been reported to have transcended space and time. But the whole point being that, you know, if your etheric energy is strong enough, you can kind of pluck yourself out of the linear time stream and overcome it the same way that aliens have. So that's what happens if our etheric energy gets pretty strong. But the way we exist right now, like I said, we only have enough just to barely keep us alive, you know, just to keep us perceiving through the five senses and, you know, grind away at our jobs and feed the control system. And I think that was all by design.
Was etheric energy levels higher in ancient times?
Yeah. Actually, it was. For instance, back in ancient Egypt, for instance, let's first of all examine what would happen if etheric energy were a lot higher than it is nowadays. Well, for one, you know, people wouldn't be stuck in a strictly left brain, linear time type of mentality like we are nowadays. Back then, actually, consciousness was a little more right-brained, more symbolic. And so a lot of the initial scripts of writing that came out back then, they were hieroglyphic in nature, just because they were symbols. And they weren't just pictograms. There were actual spiritual archetypes that people who had psychic powers were able to read into and were able to see some of the metadata surrounding it, okay? But back then, ancient Egypt, for instance, speaking of hieroglyphs, they had occult rituals, they had magical procedures, incantations that produced tangible results. And if you were to try to do these today, either nothing would happen or whatever would happen, you'd have to kind of take it on faith that it's doing anything. But back then, you know, magic, occultism, alchemy, hermeticism, and all this kind of stuff, it was a lot more potent than it is nowadays. Because back then, you know, there was a lot more etheric energy going around, so which allowed consciousness to influence matter much more than it, you know, can nowadays. Also, back then, they also had certain supernatural technologies. I think they're probably most likely either Atlantean or alien artifacts. But what they were is they were devices that used conscious energy combined with etheric energy in order to manipulate space-time, okay? So, like one example being the so-called Ark of the Covenant. You know, I wrote a whole article on the Ark of the Covenant and its history and what it could do. And all the Ark of the Covenant was, it was like a, well, I mean, the outer box of it, which we know as the Ark of the Covenant, that was just a container for a really powerful non-terrestrial artifact that it was located in Egypt originally, and then in around 1550 BC, it was taken out of Egypt by the Hyksos, who were exiled out of Egypt. And they built a box for it, and they took it into central Canaan, where they set it up in the original Temple of Solomon. But the Ark of the Covenant was known for really weird supernatural powers, you know, like frying people and being able to levitate and being surrounded by this glowing energy field that seemed to have its own artificial intelligence to it. Well, the interesting thing about the Ark of the Covenant is that over the centuries, it grew weaker and weaker until eventually it was so weak it only assumed a symbolic function. And then when the temple was sacked, you know, it disappeared from history. Well, but if you go back several centuries before that, I mean, it was at the total peak of its power. And that's where you get a lot of the myths surrounding what the Ark of the Covenant was capable of. You know, it was like a more magical, strange, supernatural time back then. And I mean, there's other weird things back then, too. Like, for instance, in Egypt, they had this practice of creating what are called animated statues. And it's weird. It's kind of like the movie Mannequin. I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yeah, I did, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, it's the idea of taking an effigy of a human and imbuing it with a really strong etheric energy body, let's say of a deceased person. And it would actually animate the statue and make it move around and talk and give prophecies and even bleed some of its etheric energy into sick people and heal them. And that's not anything you can do nowadays. That's one example. You also had the Jewish practice of what are called, well, I'm not saying Jewish, but the Semitic practice back then of what are called the teraphim. And what these are literally talking heads. It's like you take a head of a dead person and you do some magical stuff to it, put like a gold plate under its tongue with magical inscriptions on it, and you mount the head to a wall. I mean, this is bizarre, but that's one of the things that they did back then. It was a form of necromancy. And this head would actually start talking and, you know, give prophecies and advice to the people that came up to it. Eventually, you know, the practice was outlawed, and right around, you know, 1000 or 800 BC, it became nothing more than a myth. But several hundred years earlier, all these things from animated statues to the Ark of the Covenant to these talking heads to, you know, really weird occult rituals and stuff, it was all a lot more potent than it could ever be since that time. And the reason for that, of course, is because what I propose is that, you know, etheric energy was stronger back then. So, you know, that's kind of like, you know, if you think about solar powered robots and solar energy, well, if the sun is stronger, then it's all active. But if the sun goes away, then they all become inactive.
Good point.
Right. So if you replace solar radiation with etheric energy and, you know, solar robots with these you know, occult devices, then, you know, it starts making more sense. So, you know, the etheric energy levels on Earth, they fluctuate up and down over history. It seems to be tied into the precession of the equinoxes. You know,
just going to ask you about that. Yep.
Yeah, you know, the 25 or 26,000 year cycle, you know, with the Earth's axis kind of wobbling in a slow circle around that. It seems to be tied into that. And actually, you know, the weird thing about the precession of the equinoxes, you know, they say it's about 25 or 26,000 years. Well, coincidentally, that's exactly how many light years we are from the galactic center. So, you know, it suggests to me a form of electromagnetic, or, you know, even something more exotic, some kind of a resonance between energy traveling between us here and the galactic center, and how that, you know, then locks phase with our precession of the equinoxes, you know, over the cycle. And yeah, if you want to look at these cycles that are tied into the precession of the equinoxes, you'd have to go to the Vedic literature talking about the different Yuga cycles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kali Yuga, you know, Satya Yuga, and so on. Well, this one guru, Sri Yukteswar, actually, he died in 1936. He took this idea of the four different ages discussed in the Vedic literature, and he tied it to the precessional cycle. And basically what he says is that the Kali Yuga, which is like the lowest point of this energetic cycle, one of these Kali Yuga ages lasts 1,200 years, and there's two of them in a row. So, you know, he's saying that we've been in this Kali Yuga for the past 2,400 to 2,600 years. So, you know, from about, let's say, 600 to 800 BC to right about now, that's how long we've been in it, and which corresponds perfectly to how long it's been since, you know, a lot of this occult technology in the ancient past has stopped working. So, you know, it makes sense that, for about 2,400 years, we've been in this etherically depleted energy region, and only now are we starting to come out of it. You know, which begs the question, what's going to happen if it starts going up again?
So are we in for another die-off or a big extinction event?
It depends on how you look at it. Well, actually, the next question is, what would bring about this event, right? You know, just different theories about what could cause a global cataclysm. Everything relating from, you know, the whole end of the Mayan cycles to some sort of a twin sun that's going to come through and tip our poles. If you look at everything together, ultimately what it comes down to is you've got a convergence of a ton of different cycles that for some reason are all coming together at the same time. So you might have 10 total reasons why change could happen on a global scale, and I don't think any of those reasons is entirely invalid. You know, I think they're all contributing to what could be going on. I looked at what is it that could cause pretty much the majority of these end times prophecies. And what I concluded is that, you know, one explanation really explains most of them. And that would be the increase of Earth's natural ambient etheric energy levels. If that were to happen, you can pretty much explain, you know, I'd say 75% of what's predicted to occur during these times. So if etheric energy were to increase once again, I mean, there's a huge chain of consequences that would happen because of it. So I'm going to go through some of them. And, you know, a lot of it ties into human evolution itself. Like, for instance, I talked about how the etheric body allows the mind to influence a body in a much greater extent than it can normally, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and this goes not only for moving our limbs and so on, but also the idea of changing our own genes. In other words, if our etheric body gets stronger, we are also more capable of rewriting our own genetics. So if you have a planet Earth, and if you were to dump into it a huge quantity of etheric energy, that would allow pretty much every species on Earth a much more easy time of modifying its own gene code. And actually, to make sense of this, you actually have to get into some occult stuff about how souls tie into species. And where that leads is, it's the idea that animal species have kind of like a group soul, like a group consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And they have this presiding spirit for each species. So, like, you know, the same way that humans, each of us has an ego for each person, like we have our own individual spirit. Well, for animals who aren't as evolved, they have a spirit for their entire species rather than for each individual manifestation of that species, like one animal. Well, what that allows, it allows that spirit for each species, that group consciousness, to mass modify its own genes if necessary, and if there is enough etheric energy to allow it to do so. Okay, so in the distant past, when you've had these explosions of life or these rapid genetic mutations happening, you know, all over the world, I think a lot of it can be attributed not only to like natural stuff like, you know, supernovas and so on, creating radiation and causing mutations, but also etheric energy allowing the group spirit of these different species to modify its own gene code and therefore jump to the next level. It's kind of like a transplanting a plant from a small pot to a large pot.
The upgrade.
Yeah, it's the upgrade. And my point here being that, you know, it's not always necessary for aliens to come in and genetically engineer something in a test tube and seed it on Earth. There's also the idea of self-guided evolution, provided you have the impulse for it and you have the etheric energy for it, which then allows matter to be rewritten, you know, genes to be updated, and so on and so on. Okay, so if you go back in human history, the different predecessor species and races that we've had leading up to Homo sapiens sapiens, you've had different groups in the past, like, you know, like we talked about the Neanderthals leading to the Cro-Magnons and so on. Well, it's possible that not only was there alien genetic intervention back then, but there also could have been a rapid shift in the amount of etheric energy, allowing natural mutation to take place a lot quicker than it's happening right now. Mm-hmm. So in other words, you know, in accordance with the etheric energy cycles, which go up and down, you also have the level of evolutionary advancement in the world going up and down as well. So it kind of corresponds. So, okay, so take that and now think about our own future right now and what would happen once etheric energy levels were to go up again. Well, it would definitely have an influence on our genetics. It would change, well, first of all, it would change our awareness, it would change our consciousness and our level of perception. And that then in turn would affect our etheric bodies, which then would rewrite our genetic code. And therefore, it really wouldn't take too long. You know, it might only take 1,000 years, 2,000 years for a relatively new type of human to naturally evolve. And interestingly, that ties into the whole Nordic, the positive Nordic alien agenda, which I've researched for some time as well. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to counter this whole gray hybridization program. And the gray hybridization program, it aims to cripple our genetics before this etheric changeover can happen. Mm-hmm. They're trying to lock us into place so that when it happens, you know, we're too psychically weak and, you know, lacking the whole spirit component to rewrite our own genes.
I believe you. I definitely feel that going on right now. Some kind of squeeze, some sealing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. They're trying to put the shackles on us before we have the ability to, you know, fly away, okay? So, and they're trying to do that genetically. But the positive Nordic agenda, they're doing the opposite. They're trying to increase our awareness, our discernment, our connection to spirit, and basically trying to get us to naturally, using the natural process of rewriting our own genetic code, trying to naturally create a new human species that is more intelligent, you know, more discerning, more intuitive, and, you know, just more alive and responsible than what we are right now. So they're trying to pull us in the opposite direction. But they also use genetic modification, but it's more through, like I said, through our own self-guided evolution, mm-hmm. and, you know, or through natural interbreeding as well. But you know, they're kind of like the counterpoise to the negative gray agenda, you know, even though they themselves often use grays as, you know, robot workers. So when I say gray agenda, I'm talking about the negative alien groups that use grays to, hybridize us with the gray genome. You know, which the Nordics, the positive Nordics at least, are not trying to do.
Interesting.
So, you know, if you were to be able to look through a window into the future, what you would see is you would see a human being who doesn't 100% look like us. You know, they might have larger eyes, larger brain, which is exactly what we now know about the Nordic beings who claim to be time travelers from our own future. In other words, we're moving in that direction. But it won't necessarily happen, like I said, through test tube genetic engineering, but rather through our own self-guided evolution, thanks to our increased awareness, and also thanks to the increased etheric energy levels on Earth. But, you know, that's in the distant future. What I want to focus on now, I guess, is what are the more immediate effects of a raising of etheric energy? Well, one of the first ones is that it would start activating some of our clairvoyant abilities. So we would be able to see things that formerly we could not. And that includes etheric energy fields surrounding people and plants and objects. It includes what are known as etheric thought forms. And what those are just normally invisible constructs floating around us in the ether. You know, they themselves are made of etheric energy.
Sorry to interrupt, but I just want to ask, do you think some people who have no idea about this stuff would just lose it if they saw that stuff right away?
Yeah, and who knows how much of that is going on now.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and mention now not only the increase in level in cases of insanity, you know, psychosis and so on, but also problems with what I call the negative reality feedback loop. That's where, you know the idea of reality creation, where your mind and your emotions, they shape probability, so you attract certain experiences. Well, if you're extremely paranoid and fearful, you have the etheric energy field that you put out through that, you know, that's imbued with your emotions of fear and paranoia, it actually starts pulling in experiences that confirm it. And so, you know, if you're really scared of aliens or demons or, you know, it can even be like government agents or something like that, you start manifesting these things in your reality and they confirm your fear. And if you don't watch yourself, it'll create this really bad feedback loop where the more scared you are, the more you pull it in, you know, the more scared you are, the more you pull it in. Ugh. And I've known, I'd say, about a handful of people who took that to its very end, and you know, they eventually either had suicide, schizophrenia, ended up in mental institutions.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, these could be precursors to what would happen in the future if people don't take control of their own minds and keep a watch of their fears and so on. You know, I mean, if reality were to get more responsive to thought, you know, due to the increased etheric energy levels, allowing consciousness to influence matter more, then yeah, that would be a pretty big problem.
Well, really switching gears here, that's all a lot to take in, and you did a wonderful job explaining everything, but I wanted to hear also about your music as we begin to wrap up here. I was reading that many of your songs you actually heard in a dream before you recorded them. So what is the relationship between dreams and music?
Okay, well, let me tell you a quick story here. When I was 7 years old, I had this lucid dream where I was underwater and I was breathing, and I realized I was breathing. And so therefore I realized, wait a minute, I can't breathe underwater. So therefore I'm lucid. Well, at that exact moment, I tried to pick up a rock off the ground and hold it in my hand as tightly as I could, and hoping that I could possibly wake up with it and bring it, you know, into my waking state and show people, hey, look, I was in this dream. Well, it's dream logic. You know, I was only 7 years old, so don't blame me for being. Well, unfortunately, I woke up in another dream thinking I was awake, but it was still a dream, and the rock had turned into like a little M&M, and I was hungry, so I ate it. Anyway, I woke up and I was, you know, really disappointed that I couldn't take this proof out of a dream into my waking world. But, you know, of course, now in retrospect, I know that you really can't take anything out of there. But actually, it turns out you can. Music is one of the few commodities you can take out of a dream and have it be as real in the waking world as it is in the dream world.
You're right. That's true.
You know? So to me, music that I discover in dreams, it's kind of like a treasure. It's like a magical thing that it's from another world. It's from another realm. And if I bring it here and people listen to it, they're hearing something that was in my dream that came from another realm. So, you know, music is one of those things that it stirs the soul. You know, it creates up certain resonances within us. And for that reason, you know, dreams also come from the soul. You know, they're projected by the subconscious. So that's the link then between music and dreams, that they both ultimately come from the same place, which is the soul, the subconscious, you know, another realm. That's where music should come from. Now, you know, of course, there's the soulless corporate music you hear on the radio, which doesn't come from any of that. You know, it comes from focus groups and using music theory to engineer a song that would appeal to the masses.
Yeah.
You know, and it's completely devoid of genuine feelings and any kind of sort of otherworldly impulse.
And unfortunately, it's really popular and people buy it.
Yeah, supply and demand, you know, you got shallow music and you have people with shallow tastes, so, you know, it kind of goes together, and it's a big industry. But myself, you know, I try to avoid all that as much as I can, and I look to dreams, I look to otherworldly feelings and impulses for my music, because ultimately what I want to do is I want to create music that when people listen to it, they get nudged in that direction. You know, they kind of forget that they're here in 3D, you know, as a human in the control system, and they they feel like, you know, they get reminded of their spiritual home in a way, or, you know, or the spiritual future, which we're all heading towards.
Yeah, there's emanations in music. So if there can be some more positive emanations, and not in the cheesy way, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but just more higher frequency on a soul level, that's great. We need more of that right now, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, in occultism, there's the idea of sigils, which are these drawn symbols that embody a certain thought, a certain will, a certain energy. Well, music is the audio equivalent of a sigil. You know, it's the equivalent. It's a vehicle for conveying a person's energies and vibes. Okay, so you know, some people do this intentionally. Some people do it unintentionally. One way this would manifest is, you know, when you listen to a song, and the energy of the artist will come through and actually impress itself on your mind and on your soul, you know, for some time. And for me, you know, it usually takes about 12 to 24 hours to really feel the full effects of it. So for example, you could have a death metal song recorded by this really positive guy, and you know, 12 to 24 hours from now, you'll feel fine. You know, it's not going to affect you in any way. And then you listen to some country song, you know, performed by some person who's like a drunk, demon possessed addict or something, and you'll start feeling kind of down and icky a day later. Well,
yeah.
So you know, it's independent of the genre. It really depends on the energy of the person. And so that's why I think it's very important for any of us who are positive people, who have some sort of spiritual awareness, who have any musical inclinations, to go ahead and follow those as deeply as we can. Because by creating music, not only are we exercising our spirits and our inner creativity of who we really are, but we also radiate our vibes and energies into the world. And that in turn can help uplift others in a subconscious way. You know, and it does it more deeply than logic ever could. You know, I mean, it's one thing to have an article that explains something to you, but it's another to have an energy coming through that props you up underneath and allows you, you know, to be more effective as a spiritual warrior in this world.
That's right. And some people, some singers or musicians, are just kind of good at opening doorways for people to allow the spirit realm to be a little more accessible.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it just has both its good and positive aspects, right? You know,
right.
On the one hand, it can allow good energies to come through and, you know, connect with positive stuff. But on the other hand, you know, it can also be used for black magic and dark occult purposes.
Yeah, I know. Henrik and I always say, you know, like a lot of this pop music and hip hop, that is demonic to us, you know?
Yeah.
It's worse than any death metal I've heard, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's not always a genre. It's a people behind it, and the whole intention behind the song itself. Okay. Yeah.
So why are we drawn to a specific genre of music? And last question for you, what makes you personally drawn to metal music?
Okay. Yeah. You know, well, ultimately what it comes down to is, you know, every soul is different. You know, we all have individual souls with our own past life history, our own destinies, our own emotional makeups. So it's kind of like a vibrational fingerprint that we all carry around with us. And this vibrational fingerprint is a certain archetype that can also be translated into music. So, you know, there's different kinds of music for different kinds of soul archetypes, I guess you could say. Now, this is completely independent of like surface level musical attraction, which is, you know, just mundane stuff based on biology, based on tradition. You know, like, you know, you grew up on something, so therefore you like it just because your parents played it.
Yeah.
Or like sentimental reasons, like, you know, the song's not even good, but you heard it during a meaningful time in your life. So every time you hear the song, it kind of triggers that same emotion. You know, these are all superficial things that don't actually relate to the intrinsic musical soul resonant value, which is exactly what I look for in music. You know, it's this thing I try to do in my songs. Like in my songs, you know, if you were to strip away all the textures, all the ambience, and have just a pure melody, the best melodies, I think, that I can come up with are ones that even if you have just a pure melody, it's still creates a sense of weird spiritual recognition within you, like a sense of otherworldliness and an impulse for transcendence.
Well, you definitely have that element in your music.
Oh, well, thanks. It's what I go for. And, you know, in the future, I'll try to hone in on it even more and more. So,
what's next for you? What's happening?
Well, you know, I'll continue working on my music and my research, you know, especially heavy metal, because, you know, metal has the archetype of power and transcendence, you know, especially if you imbue it with the otherworldly stuff, modulating melodies, really haunting atmospheres and so on. It you know, it creates that sense of otherworldly spiritual divine element combined with the power that's naturally inherent in metal. So if you combine the two, then you get this really strong revolutionary spiritual impulse, you know, to transcend whatever situation you're in and enter the next phase of your own evolution, which I think on a macroscopic scale mirrors, I think, what's going to be happening to humanity in the coming decades, you know, transcending our current situations and moving into this new, more magical and more alive state of existence.
Please mention your websites and tell us about the song we're about to hear called Deep Black Lake.
Okay, my main website is montauk.net. That's MONTALK.net. And it's been online since 1998. It's a really great site. I hope you take a look at it because I got huge quantities of material on there you can look through. And actually, I have it all in print now. So if you want to read it in hard copy, you can pick up the entire site as a 1,400-page, two-volume book. And also, I got my music website, NeptunianHorizon.com. There you can download my album for free if you want, or you can pick up a hard copy CD as well. So the song we're going to be listening to is called Deep Black Lake. And it's based on a dream I had where I was walking around in the sunny resort town, and everyone was really happy and cheery. But I walked to this part of town, and it started getting darker and darker, and I ended up at this lake surrounded by these gray trees, and it was really dark, in like a swampy area. I went to the bottom of the lake, and I realized at the bottom were the bodies of all these people I had seen back in the resort town, and they were all chained to the bottom, hooked up with breathing apparatuses in a state of suspended animation, kind of like in the Matrix movie.
Mm.
And it turns out that the people in the resort town, that was all the things that these people in the lake were dreaming. In other words, their real condition was being trapped at the bottom of this dark lake, but they were dreaming that they were existing back in this happy resort place. And that was kind of symbolic of our reality here today, where, you know, no matter how good, how much wealth you have, how much power you have here in the 3D control system, you're still within the control system. And unless you spiritually liberate yourself, you're going to be stuck there at the bottom of that deep black lake. So that's what my song is about.
All right. Well, thanks, Tom, so much for coming on today. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
And thanks everyone for listening. And here is Deep Black Lake.
Brothers who've fallen asleep in the depths of a deep black hole.